The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From the crossroads of Merrick Road and Sunrise Highway in beautiful Merrick, Long Island, New York, this is Long Island WGBB Sports Talk New York, 95.9. 12:40 a.m. on your dial. I'm your host, Mike Wadone, joined, as always, by the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. 516-623-1240 is our number. Again, that's 516-623-1240. Got a lot to go over tonight. All sports, all the time, with a New York flair. Going to talk a little tennis, also French Open with a little New York flair. Talk playoffs Knicks with Rob Verdan. And then later on in the end of the show, we'll have Brian Palermo on, our Yankee expert, to talk a little New York Yankees, where they're at. And I'm sure we'll sprinkle in a little New York Mets. But before we get to any of that, let's welcome in Cap, Chris Caputo. Cap, good to see you again.
Mike, thanks for having me. Good to see you again. It's June, even though it still, Mike, does not feel like it. But hopefully this week we'll turn the corner.
Absolutely. Certainly not June weather out there, but yeah, June flavor in everything. You got Stanley Cup final playoffs. We will get to some Islanders talk, I'm sure, in a couple of weeks when we talk about their new GM and some Rangers things. Was talking a little hockey with a few hockey fans this weekend, but there's too much basketball, baseball, high level. You know, Mets are back in first place, so all is good with the world.
Yeah, nice to sweep the Rockies, get that out of the way, fly to the West Coast, and four with the Dodgers, then three more with the Rockies. So, you know, I would say if you're trying to take those seven games, you have to go you got to go 4-3, but you could go better than that, and I think you come back and start heating things up.
Yeah, and you know what? Nice to see Juan Soto at least getting a little bit of bat on the ball. You know, he's walked. He struggled, obviously, putting the ball in play, but when he does, he's producing. But, man, how about Francisco Lindor, huh?
Yeah, I don't care what team it's against. It's nice to have him there at the top of the lineup. And then also when you have a tie game, a guy that you can count on to put the ball in play, hit a home run. And, you know, more importantly for me, Mike, this bullpen has been absolutely stunning. No matter who you put out there, they've been great. Finally today, after 30 consecutive outs, Edwin Diaz finally gave up a hit. You know, he was almost chasing a batter, you know, 33 in a row that DeGrom had done at one point. But pretty much he's been unhittable this year, and I think he's healthy and throwing strikes. After he walks a batter, I think he throws like 8% strikes to the next batter. So balls to the next batter. So he knows.
He zones in.
Yeah, once he's done that, he's going to throw strikes, and maybe a guy steals on him. But it's been nice to see. You know, the Yankees have hit a rough patch, but they've been good. So it's been good. If you have a chance, get out and watch some baseball, Yankee Stadium, Citi Field, and enjoy the weather.
You know, one thing, I was pretty surprised yesterday. I watched a little bit, as I was telling you before, early of the Yankee game. And I know it was early in mid-afternoon in Los Angeles. They had a good crowd, but not full by any stretch of the imagination out there. I mean, I guess there's just too much to be doing in L.A. on a beautiful day like that. But
yeah,
that's a place I got to go see. That stadium
you
just
do,
looks
but
unbelievable.
I have to say you have to drive there. There's no
public transportation, right?
And it's also not the greatest of areas. Yeah. So when you're going, that's what you're going for. And remember, a 7:15 game for us is really a 4:15 game there. So these guys are out in the sunlight, as opposed to tomorrow night, a 10:15 game for the Mets is really 7:15 out there. But it'll be an interesting series after the Mets took 2 of 3, which I had thought they could have won all three against the Dodgers recently. So hopefully the matchups work in a Mets favor and they start hitting the ball.
So if I were to ask you, this is probably an easy one, but what do Derek Jeter and Francisco Lindor, how are they linked today?
Today?
Surprised you don't know this one.
Probably has to do with homers, the amount of homers they
have. Yeah, so Francisco Lindor passed Derek Jeter for fourth on the all-time list home runs for shortstops.
There you go.
Yeah. And interesting because, I mean, Jeter was never thought of really as a power hitter, but, you know, Hall of Famer. Had some pop. Lindor, still a very young guy, at least, in my circles, has a lot of tread left on the tire. I'm just thrilled for him. He's, to me, you know, I mean, I don't know. you talk leadership on the Mets, you talk character and all that kind of stuff. I just love Lindor. He just goes out, does his thing, smile on his face, and loves the game.
It's nice to hear that he checks in on every player after all the series are over,
yes.
Which I think is just great clubhouse stuff. So
yeah, that's...
I'm excited here to talk a little bit of tennis because,
yeah.
You know, it's an American thing going on here right now.
Absolutely. And we're joined right now for the second time on the show, Jamie Loeb, who is our... If it's okay, Jamie, we're gonna call you our Sports Talk New York touring pro, because you always give us great insight. And once again, from the WTA Tour, Jamie Loeb, how are you, Jamie?
I'm good. Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely,
it's a pleasure.
Oh, it's
a pleasure.
Thank you. The pleasure's all ours. You know, Chris and I were talking before you came on. We looked at your schedule. We follow you every tournament and. Chris, your brother actually met up with Jamie in one of the tournaments this year, right?
Yeah, down in Charleston. He got to see you play a couple qualifiers before you played in a round of 64, so it was nice.
Oh, I didn't even know that. That's awesome.
Yep.
Yeah, he's got a great picture with. So we're not stalking you, but we are following you, and you're our favorite pro. You know, just to kind of remind the audience, Jamie's out of Austin, New York. She was the 2015 NCAA singles champion from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and has spent, you know, a great amount of time as a touring pro. And, Jamie, I know, you know, springtime for you means clay season. So, that Charleston, you know, that's a WTA 500. That's a great event for you. And I know you've been kind of going, you've been staying mostly, I believe, if I'm correct, please correct me if I'm wrong, you know, pretty much in the United States, and, you know, this half of the hemisphere for your play. Is that correct?
Yeah. This year I've been in the U.S. and Dominican Republic.
Yeah, DR.
So
okay.
I've, you know, stayed quote unquote, local, even though I've been doing a lot of travel, but,
yes.
You know, I feel right now just, you know, there's a lot of tournaments in the U.S. and, you know, just kind of want to be a little bit closer to home. You know, yeah, I've been doing this for 10 years now. So,
that's
I've
a
definitely,
grind.
You know, yeah, I've definitely put the miles in and, you know, I still am, but just a little bit more domestic.
Well, I tell anybody who ever wants to know anything about travel, especially sports related, but anything about travel, your Instagram is fantastic for really, you know, telling the ins and outs of how to travel, you know, internationally, domestically, what airlines are great, who are terrible. If you're traveling with, you know, bags full of equipment, you always have interesting stories, it seems.
I'm so glad that, you know, someone likes that I'm putting out
there. Oh, are you kidding? Absolutely.
I definitely try to show all sides of it, the good, the bad, the okay, the ugly. You know, it's not all glamorous at my level, and especially, you know, I'm the one running the show, and I'm my own boss, agent, travel planner, all you name it. So, I definitely do like highlighting all of it, the behind the scenes and things that, you know, people don't really know or understand that goes on. It's not just about hitting a tennis ball.
Right. When we spoke with you last year around this time, you were starting to work and develop something with mentoring younger athletes. Are you still involved with that? Is that something you're still developing?
Yeah. And it's definitely developed. And, you know, now I have a nice little website too. I've been mentoring, you know, a few girls and parents.
Wonderful.
And I feel like I should probably, I definitely could make it more, or advertise it a little bit better, but I'm also still trying to play. So it's hard to juggle it all, but
sure.
Yeah, it's great. It's fun for me, to, you know, also put myself back in their positions and even working with beginner players and helping them and, you know, even finding the right coaches and, you know, how to go about things and, you know, how to help in their development and be that female influence and impact on them. And that's something that, you know, I had my sister growing up, but to have someone that's really gone through all these stages, that's what I'm here for. And, you know, I've even gone to some junior tournaments and, you know, meeting girls from all over. So, yeah, it's definitely developing and, you know, I'm really enjoying it and it kind of gives me something else to do when I'm on the road and just like, I don't know, I also feel useful.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So, Jamie, we've got the French Open going on. I'm sure you're at least keeping an eye on it. And, you know, for us, obviously, we see at least at this point, four women have moved on to the fourth round. We have Jessica Pegula. We've got Madison Keys. We've got Haley Baptiste. We've got Coco in there as well. What does this mean for the American women at this point to be advancing this far with so many?
Yeah, I definitely think it shows the depth of, you know, American tennis. Even the men are doing great as well, but just on the women's side, it just really shows the depth from, you know, all ages, levels, rankings. And, you know, I think in the past it always was you have to be, you know, 18 to 20 years old to really make it. And now it's, you know, it's any age. And so it's really great to see that and very encouraging and motivating for, you know, players like myself to keep fighting and believing out there because, you know, it only takes a couple of tournaments to really turn things around and, you know, say someone like Haley Baptiste and, you know, she's been on the ITF circuit for quite some time and then made a jump and has been doing well in WTAs and now she's making that jump in slams. You know, it can be anyone and you just got to keep putting yourself out there.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Haley Baptiste. You know, obviously somewhat of a newer name to the general tennis populace. Can you give us I know you've been following her, and she's played on the same tour that you've been playing on a little bit. Can you give us a little bit of a scouting report on her?
Yeah, I mean, you know, she has a great forehand, and, I mean, lately she's been moving a lot better. I think in the past you're able to exploit her movement a little bit. Mm-hmm. I've played against her in singles and doubles, honestly, like not in, like, the last 1 to 2 years, so not too long ago. And but, yeah, her forehand is definitely powerhouse, and you know she has a good serve, you know, great slice, and really great hands, and you know, really moves well too at the net. So yeah, she's definitely putting the pieces together. But overall, you know, she has her weapons.
So looking at the women right now, Sabalenka is getting a lot of love as the one seed, but Swiatek has won 25 straight matches at Roland Garros, and you know, she's had a little bit of a down year this year. Can you kind of compare and contrast those two as to maybe why Swiatek does well at the French?
It's funny when people say she's had a down year, right? And she's still like five in the world.
She's five in the world, right.
It's crazy. You know, I mean, clay, like, definitely she moves really well on clay and very natural. And, I mean, she had a tough match today. I was watching it, and Rybakina was, you know, really striking the ball well and, you know, just moving her around, but it was almost untouchable, and then Iga just really, you know, clawed her way in. But I think, you know, Iga's so mentally tough, and I think she just believes so much on this surface. But, you know, Sabalenka's playing great, and she's proven to be dominant, so that would be interesting if they end up playing each other. But you know, I just think also it's like a confidence factor, and people that, you know, think of it's kind of like, you know, when people see Rafa, like, play Rafa on clay, they're like, oh boy, like, you know, this is gonna be tough. And maybe to a certain extent it's similar with Iga, but yeah, she's a great athlete and all court player, so you know, just makes it tough. You have to play like Rybakina did that first set for two sets or even three sets to beat her on clay.
Yeah, that's a tough task. It's funny how we were all kind of laughing about, you know, being number five in the world, and that's quote unquote a down year, because I was listening to Andy Roddick's serve podcast, which is fantastic, and they were saying the same thing. I mean, this is someone who's won, you know, four of the last five French Opens, three in a row, as Chris said, 25 matches in a row, and she was coming in as really almost a dark horse. I mean, that's just outrageous.
Yeah, it's crazy to, you know, even think that, but also just shows how dominant deep. She is, but also the rest of the tour. I mean, the level just rises every year. Everyone's hitting the ball harder and is more physical and, you know, just not missing as much. So I think it's also just a credit to how deep women's tennis is right now. And, you know, but I'm excited to see how the rest of the tournament unfolds.
I know there's another full week, really, until, you know, this tournament is complete. But out of the four American ladies left, you know, Jess Pegula, Maddie Keys, Haley Baptiste, and, you know, who's really more of the underdog at this time, and Coco. Who would you pick at this time to really have the best shot to win this tournament?
Ooh, that's a good one, because I feel like all these players are kind of hot at the moment. I mean, Maddie Keys, you know, clay has never been her best surface, but she's, you know,
coming off a Grand Slam.
Striking the ball. Yeah, she exactly. So she has that confidence and that swagger going on.
Yeah.
I feel like Jess is one of the most consistent players on tour, just all around. Her game, her results. Also, I mean, clay, I don't think is her favorite surface, but I feel like she's very reliable. You know, Coco's done really well, so especially on clay. I don't know. I want to say Jess. I'm going to say Jess on this, and I don't have an exact reason why, but that's just what my gut is telling me.
Well, she won the tournament down in Charleston, so maybe it's some
maybe
some
that's
flavor.
Why.
There you go.
You know what? Maybe that's why.
Good call.
So, Jamie, there was some talk from Coco about criticizing the French Open for not scheduling women's matches in primetime slots. I guess you probably saw a little bit about that.
Yes, I did. I also, I think, saw Ons wrote about that as well.
Yes.
Okay. And then Amélie Mauresmo, who's the tournament director, kind of came out and disputed that notion, because people are saying they're putting the women's matches in the noon slot, which typically has the lower attendance, and it's, you know, the girls are not worthy at night. Is there a message kind of being played there to the women not being able to fill the stadium?
I mean, I can't really speak on that, because I feel everyone that I talk to really enjoys watching women's tennis and thinks it's more exciting than men, to be honest. You know, I think men's tennis, a lot of times it can just be about the serve, but in women's tennis, I feel like, you know, there's a lot more depth, like I mentioned earlier. So, I don't know. I mean, look, I play this sport, so I feel like, you know, it's always fun watching women's tennis, and especially even doubles, too. So, I don't know. I don't really know the ins and outs of the scheduling, per se, but I don't feel like there's a reason to not put women prime time.
It would not happen at the U.S. Open, I'll tell you that much. The women at the U.S. Open, I think, just brings the most flair. People want that at night. And I like the way they do it at the U.S. Open. They usually put, you know, one women's match, one men's match, and not necessarily in that order in the night session, which I think gives people a good chance to see some up-and-coming players of both, you know, male and female.
For sure. And, you know, also going back to Charleston, you know, I think that's one of the best WTAs on tour, and you get so many fans, and it's great attendance, and from qualifying there's packed stadiums, and, you know, people just like love to watch women's tennis, and I think that's great, and it really shows that, you know, women's tennis is what people want to see. So I think also maybe the location, but regardless, like, you know, if you give us women more of a chance, we'll put on a show.
I think the rest of the world, Jamie, is unfortunately is still a little behind the United States in terms of, you know, being fair to all, and absolutely recognizing that the women's game is just as exciting, if not more, like you mentioned. And we're not, trust me, you know, we don't talk tennis all that much here. We talk, you know, with you, and we talk around the U.S. Open, but you have a couple of people here. You know, I've coached high school and college tennis. Chris, his brother's been a college coach. So we follow the sport, and by far, you know, the women's game, as you mentioned, is something where it's not just about the serve. There's still strategy, especially on clay when the ball's just a little bit slower. You know, if anybody's gonna show it in prime time, it should be the French Open. But I guess for whatever reason, and it is odd that, you know, they have a female that's their tournament director, but I guess she kind of takes her marching orders from whoever. But we're all about it, and we love it. And you know, we're psyched about it. And again, we're talking to Jamie Loeb, who's our tennis touring pro and former NCAA champion. So I wanted to ask you this. This is a question I wanted to get to the last time we had you on, but we ran out of time. So you've played main draw U.S. Open. Now, if I'm correct, you've at least played qualies in the other three Grand Slams. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you take U.S. Open out of it, out of those three, out of Wimbledon, you know, French Open, Australian, out of those three, which one did you enjoy your experience the most?
probably Australia because it would have been Wimbledon, but we don't play on site for qualifying. It's offsite.
Okay.
Yeah, it is offsite, and unfortunately, they don't really treat us the same as name draw players. So you just feel like there's a hierarchy, and you're just kind of like lower on the totem pole. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, you're still playing Wimbledon, but just the setup and everything.
Sure.
It just has a different feel. And, you know, Australia, great crowds. It's an amazing venue. I mean, it's massive compared to French Open, which is a lot smaller. So, yeah, I'd say out of those three, it would be Australia. I mean, I also I think I've had my best results out of those three in Australia and Wimbledon. I think French, I made it to the second round of qualifying, where the other two have made it to the last round of qualifying. So, that's Australia.
So speaking of grass courts, I know this year the tournament up in Newport, Rhode Island is actually opening up. I believe it's dropping to a 125 or 100, but it's both male and female this year. Any thoughts about trying to qualify for that event, or are you strictly now preparing hard court?
It's a great question. I feel like my schedule changes by the week. So, you know, maybe ask me that question in 3 weeks. We'll see where I'm at or what part of the world. But, I think it's on one of my tentative schedules, but it's also difficult because I'm not playing a grass court schedule leading up to it. I'm going to be on hard court. Yeah. So just to play one tournament might be challenging, but I've been to Newport, Rhode Island before, and you know it's beautiful, and the Hall of Fame is there, so wouldn't be a bad place to play. But you know, right now I think it's on the tentative side of things, and also depending on ranking and such.
Yeah, I'm a little partial to Newport because my daughter actually went to school. She just graduated from South Virginia University, which is in Newport. So we were there all the time visiting. You know, I'm a tennis nut, so I would go to the Hall of Fame all the time. I mean, it's a wonderful facility. It is so unique that it's the only grass court tournament we really have. So I'm partial to it, but I could imagine trying to prepare for just one grass court tournament would have to be really difficult.
Yeah. Grass, you know, it's a very short season as is, and even for a week, it's also not the easiest to find grass courts or good grass courts, depending where you live. So, and you definitely don't want to show up and play first round without even touching the grass before. That's a recipe for disaster. So, yeah, there'd be a little bit more thought process of training that would go into that. So we will see.
Okay.
So, Jamie, on the men's side, Francis Tiafoe and Tommy Paul both advanced to the quarters. I believe for the men, that's the first time there's been two men in the quarters since 96.
Were you even alive in 96?
I was 1 year old.
Okay.
So I don't really remember a whole lot.
We're not going to ask any specifics from that tournament.
And then the last American to make it there was Agassi in 03. So we're looking at over 20 years. Is there something now with the men that, you know, they're pushing their way back into, you know, playing the French Open?
Yeah. I mean, you know, like I said earlier, I mean, there's a lot of depth on the women's side, but there's also a lot of depth on the men's side. And, you know, Francis and Tommy have really climbed their way up, and not only, you know, on other surfaces, but just on clay. And clay is notoriously, you know, or especially red clay, hasn't been a fan favorite for Americans for a while. So, you know, I think it's great to see, and, you know, players adapting and growing, but also, too, just having a good core group of guys just pushing each other. And I think it's motivational for everyone to see that and you know, wanting more.
Well, I guess if the American men don't have to run into Rafa Nadal anymore, maybe they do have a shot to get to the quarters.
That's right. I mean, now that Rafa retired, you know, people have a little bit of hope, but then you have Novak and Carlos. So
yeah, well, that I was going to mention.
It's not the easiest.
Ben Shelton, you know, he hadn't had a great clay season, but he was playing very well, and he ran into Alcaraz today. It still was a four setter.
Well.
Yeah, he played,
you know,
well.
He lost 10-8 in the first in the tiebreak, so he had a shot.
Yeah, it's exciting to see that. But the women have been carrying the banner on the American side at the French for quite some time. So all props to that.
yeah, you know, it's great to see it, and, you know, I love how the women are just paving the way here, and the men are just trying to catch up.
So we got two quick questions before we let you go. Number one is, I know, you know, I kind of already asked you a little bit about your schedule for the summer, but, you know, do you have anything set in stone in terms of where you're playing and what your lead-ups are?
Well, currently I'm in Sumter, South Carolina,
okay.
And I play tomorrow at 10 a.m. So that I do know. Other than that, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I will go abroad at all end of June, or if I'll stay stateside.
Okay.
Are
you still playing doubles?
Even stateside, there's just, it's kind of all over the country a little bit. So, look, everyone always asks me this question, like, oh, like, where are you going to be this week or that week? I'm like, I will let you know when I know. And nowadays that tends to be like the week before. So I wish I can give a more clear schedule for you guys, so people listening could actually follow along. But
okay, well,
I don't have that at the moment.
Well, you're busy. That's safe to say you're busy.
Yeah.
And are you continuing with doubles as well? Are you playing a lot of doubles?
Lately I've just been playing singles. I do play doubles as well, but
yeah.
A lot of these tournaments this year I've had to qualify for, and that just takes a toll on the body. And just wanting to give it my best shot on singles. You know, a lot of times too, playing doubles, it, you know, depending on the location, it's just long days. And right now I've just been wanting to, you know, try to build up my singles ranking. And once I hopefully get that in a better place, then play some more doubles. But, you know, and also finding a partner that, you know, I play with consistently. Because I think for a while I've been playing with some different people the past, like, year and a half. And it's hard to really build something together when you're playing with different people. So just right now focusing on singles, mm-hmm. and then I think, you know, in the near future play some doubles, and hopefully with a consistent partner.
Gotcha. All right, and then here's the last thing. Are you still, I know you were doing this for a while, where people could send kind of videotapes of themselves, and you're able to break down almost like a coach virtually how their game is and different things. Are you still involved with that?
Yeah, I love how you follow me on social media,
yeah.
and like remember these things.
I know, absolutely.
I think
it's cool. I mean, really.
Yes, it's actually an online coaching platform called Tandem. So yes,
okay.
I am still on that. So if you ever want to send me
a
video of your serve,
well, I was
going to.
Yes, I was.
Want advice?
I think I'm going to send you a tape. But here's the thing: I'm pretty consistent forehand. Serve is decent. I can volley the ball well, but my backhand, I've struggled with my backhand my entire life. I hit a two-hander. I can slice the ball really well one hand, but if you were going to teach somebody, you know, just basics off the two-hand backhand, you know, what's the biggest mistake that people make on their two-handed backhand?
Well, first off, to see it. Second of all, I love my backhand, so I'll gladly help you with that.
Okay.
I think one thing is, I mean, it really depends, but I would say a lot of times people kind of come out of the backhand too soon with their right arm, like the arm's
mm-hmm.
supposed to be more tucked, and
yes.
I feel that's kind of like a hidden, not secret, but really emphasizing like that shoulder turn, but like not allowing your right arm to be the one leading. Like you want that left arm to come around.
Okay. I'm taking notes
right arm
as you're
is
talking.
The one to track the ball.
Okay.
So yeah, I know. Look, this is like free advice.
No. I'm going to send you. I'm going to go via the platform. I promise.
But
I hope Margaret Soans is not listening.
You're so.
Is your opponent Margaret Soans listening for tomorrow's match?
Honestly, I just saw the order of play as well.
You have no idea.
If she is, too good. I mean, she doesn't know a whole lot about me, I guess, right now. But I can teach her how to hit a backhand if she needs.
There you go. Well, hopefully
maybe after the match.
You school her tomorrow and you take care of it. Jamie, it's been a pleasure talking to you again. Really, thank you for joining us. All the best. Hope you have a great summer. I am going to send you a tape. And I'm going to go through that platform, because if anybody can help me on my backhand, it's definitely you.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
You know, and hopefully, you know, we'll get that backhand to be laser sharp.
I would appreciate it. Jamie Loeb, everybody. Jamie, all the best. Have a great summer, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, guys.
All right. We'll be back in just a minute to talk a little NBA playoffs with Rob Verdant.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the second half hour of Long Island's WGBB Sports Talk New York. You're on 95.9, 1240 AM. 516-623-1240 is the number if you'd like to call in. We had a great half hour talking New York-based tennis and French Open with Jamie Loeb. But now we're lucky to be joined once again by Rob Verdant, former St. John Red Storm player, was a member of the Denver Nuggets and the Warriors and Bobcats coaching staff, talk a little NBA playoffs. Rob, welcome back to the program. Great to have you on.
Hey, thanks for having me back, guys.
Oh, absolutely.
Appreciate it. So this time of year, we're not used to here in New York talking about the NBA playoffs, but I think people were surprised to see the Knicks get that far after beating the Boston Celtics. But then I think a lot of people around here thought the Knicks were the favorite in that series. Can you give your insights into really what happened in the Knicks-Pacers series?
Yeah, sure. But first, you know, if you'll indulge me, you know, I haven't been associated or affiliated with the team in a bunch of years. And I got some young boys here in the house and my wife, and we basically adopted the Knicks over
all
the
right.
last 2 years. And so it gave us something to do together as a family, and you know, basically tried to watch every single game. So you know, these games, these playoff games, were very meaningful in my house.
Yeah,
and it was a joy to watch them. You know, Coach Tibbs and the Knicks put 50 game win seasons
yeah.
together in a row, two of them, and I think there's a lot to look forward to. First and foremost, without even talking about what just happened, but I think there's a lot to look forward to in New York for with the Knicks, and I know we're excited about it here. So, yeah, go ahead. Shoot whatever questions you got.
Yeah, so I think let's start with Game 1, because I believe that the series definitely took a change. Knicks up double digits, 3 minutes to go, and, you know, I think they agreed that they took the foot off the pedal. How does something like that happen in an NBA, you know, Eastern Conference final game?
Yeah, that was tough. That was tough to deal with, you know. But so much happens within a game. There were so many games within the game where momentum plays a major role. And you know, there's offensive momentum and there's defensive momentum. And there were plenty of times, not only in Game One but throughout the series, where the Knicks kind of lost defensive momentum, and you can see it in their communication, in their missed rotations, not communicating on switches and things like that. So that was that game one was the first kind of telltale sign that this was gonna go. You know, if you're a Knicks fan, you want it to go. If you're a Pacer fan, it's gonna go
yeah.
a bunch of games, because when they took game one in New York, I mean, I was like, well, this might be a long series.
Yeah, that was a microcosm of the series, because then you have another game where the Knicks, you know, last Sunday, Mike and I were on the air, Knicks are losing by 20, and they come back and win that game. So I think you kind of had the other way, too, where guys like Karl-Anthony Towns would show up and say, this is my game. But I felt like that first game was the toughest for them to recover from, and then You know, last night, the second half, it just kind of got away from them. Is there a part of the Pacers game or a part of the Knicks game that you think maybe was the key? Because I know for me, watching them pick and roll Karl Anthony Towns and Jalen Brunson was just awful to watch.
Yeah, that was tough. That was tough. And I think that's something we could talk about a little bit later in the interview. But the three things that the Pacers have going for them, is speed. Number one, speed. Number two, shooting. Okay, and those are momentum things. So if you keep scoring on the fast break, if the Knicks did not get back multiple times last night,
yep.
And those are momentum builders, and that's something that you got to try and put the brakes on. You use your timeouts or whatever. However you do that, you put your defensive specialist group in there to stop it. But the Knicks weren't able to do that. So, and then there's the Pacers shooting. I mean, they're timely shooters, and we saw that throughout the season, throughout the series. I'm sorry. And then lastly, their depth. They had fresh guys, in the fourth quarter. And, the Knicks, Brunson was fighting 94 feet every time they took the ball out of bounds. Every
Unreal.
Time the Knicks took the ball out of bounds, those guys were up there pressuring, and that wears on you. So the shooting, the speed, and the depth of the Pacers ultimately were the things that did the Knicks in.
And we're talking with Rob Verdan. Rob, you mentioned, Coach Tibbs, two back-to-back 50-win seasons. Hadn't been done in New York, and we can't even tell. But, I'm a big Tibbs fan. I think he's done a great job. He's been catching a little bit of heat here. I mean, it is New York. You're familiar with that. I think, anytime that a team here doesn't perform to the top level, the coach is always going to catch a little heat. Do you think there's anything that he deserves even the slightest bit of criticism on, maybe with his rotations or trying to develop the bench a little bit sooner? Or, are you pretty much in the camp that he did everything pretty much correctly?
No, I think he did a lot of things right. I think he's, we're always evolving. We're always learning. And I'm sure that he would say the same thing. I mean, and you saw the last three playoff games against Indiana. He started utilizing the bench more because
yes.
he realized he needed some of those fresh legs.
Yeah.
Some of those guys produce.
Yep.
But with that, he'll walk into the offseason with confidence.
Yes.
Saying, I can go ahead and play 9-10 guys, and let's start the season off possibly next year like that. But I'll tell you this. When you look at the history of Tibbs as a head coach, players improve with him. They get better. So, you look at Jalen Brunson when he came over from Dallas, where he was a sixth man coming off the bench. And now everybody was talking about him as an MVP candidate, right, this
mm-hmm.
year. So he's improved under Tibbs. Tibbs is a great staff here in New York. A lot of guys I know, and I know they're toilers, they're workers.
Yes.
Everybody there works. So the same can be said for the type of player Tibbs wants. He wants workers. So when we talk about Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns, some sort of confusion on pick-and-roll coverage, well, guess what? They're going to work on that this offseason.
Yeah,
and they're going to improve on that. And that's what gives me and should give New York, all of New York, excitement for what's to come in October.
Absolutely. So the other side now, you have Oklahoma City who just has done, minus really one kind of hiccup in the Western Conference Finals, really was very dominant, had a great season. Now they're matching up with Indiana. How do you see the finals playing out? What's your thoughts on that?
It's going to be unique. Two small market teams. It's going to be interesting because Oklahoma City brings something different to the table.
Oh, yeah.
I would have said, if you asked me at the beginning of the season, I said, oh, they're not ready to contend yet. But they've grown so much just within this year and within these playoffs that they're there. Okay, so what do they have? They have the MVP, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. What's he doing? He's bringing back the mid-range game. And he's effective. They have great defenders. They have the deep, deep team that can switch defensively. They have length at the rim. They don't have necessarily great, girth and size other than Lou Dort, but they have height at the rim, so they'll protect the rim. Now, on the other hand, you got the Pacers, the things we talked about before, with their speed, their shooting, and their depth. If they get hot, they have just as good a chance.
Yes.
So it's going to really be something watching these two small market teams battle this out, because this is a series that I think can go seven games.
Yeah, and I think Oklahoma City likes to run, unlike the Knicks, who are trying to slow the game down. Do you think that the Pacers are going to use their bench and press up 94 feet against Oklahoma City, or do you think that Rick Carlisle changes things up a little bit?
Well, I imagine he'll change things up. I think we will see some of that. However, the let's face it, Jalen Brunson's the head of the snake for the Knicks. But you take the head of the snake out by pressuring the heck out of him for three quarters. In the fourth quarter, he struggled a little bit. I don't know necessarily, only because I've watched Oklahoma, but I haven't studied them as much as I have the Knicks this season. But they have a pretty deep team as well.
Yep.
And they have capable ball handlers and decision makers, and they play very, very well in drawing kicks. So more or less, whoever brings the ball up for them probably can initiate in the offense. So I think we will see that from Rick Carlisle, that pressure defense. But I think he'll recognize if he has to pull back from it.
Yep.
And be a little bit more solid in the half court.
So we'll probably see some high-paced games here. Just like the Pacers have former Knick Obi Toppin, the Thunder stole away Hartenstein for 3 years, $87 million. I believe the Knicks offered $472. So it's interesting to see some of these Knicks play on a different team. I'm not sure how much you saw him play this year, but he definitely is having an effect on the Oklahoma City Thunder. And I think, they were the best team in the NBA this year, and partially because they brought him in.
Yeah, he's made a huge difference. And, Chet Holmgren was hurt, I think, beginning of the year. And then he, Hartenstein held the position down, and then Hartenstein got hurt at some point towards the end of the year, and Holmgren held the fort down. And then both of them together, though, they did play together a lot during the middle of the season, and there's a good chemistry there between the two of them. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the only number the Knicks could get to in terms of securing Hartenstein next following season was the number that they offered him.
Yeah.
It's just Oklahoma City gave him more. And I think, at this stage, you gotta go. I mean, you just gotta take that and secure that for your family.
Yeah, that's a tough one to turn down. I know I was reading something trying to explain, the early bird rights, and that the guys who are able to negotiate contracts in the NBA. I mean, you have to have like an MBA from Wharton School of Business to understand that stuff, but you don't have to have an MBA to understand the difference between what Oklahoma City was able to offer and New York. One last thing. I just wanted to ask you, if you're the GM, let's play GM. Let's go back to the Knicks for a second. So, a lot to be excited about and the things that they need to improve on, of course, from a technical standpoint. If there was anything you would like to add to that Knick team for next season, is it more shooting, another defender? If you had a crystal ball and you could basically just kind of do what you want or bring in somebody, make a deal, what would you see would be really a huge key for the Knicks next year to kind of take that next step?
I think right off the bat, starting with what you already have, a healthy Mitchell Robinson for 82 games would have been great. Because when he was coming off the bench towards the end of the year when he came back from injury, and then all of a sudden he and Towns are starting together in the playoffs. And that's tough. That's tough to develop that type of chemistry because this is really Towns' first season with the Knicks, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, here we go. He didn't have Mitchell Robinson. Now he's playing with a guy who's bigger than him. It does cause a little bit of unrest and confusion at times, so... that would be first and foremost. I would like to see him healthy, and then I would like to see them go out and get a really, really veteran, smart, capable backup point guard.
Hmm.
somebody who can spell. I mean, Johnson got some really long rests in the last three games. I don't know if you realize that. And, you know, that's the type of, those are the type of types of rests he needs throughout the 82 games.
Sure. Without a doubt. And, yeah, and when you bring someone in, like you said, a real capable guy who can give, he doesn't have to then, you know, he's not picking up his fourth and fifth foul out of fatigue and where he's got to go to the bench early, you know, and in bunches. I'm sure, you know, you, as you said, you would know better than us. That's just a huge advantage to have.
Yeah, real big. Yeah, it just gives you confidence as a coach.
So you said your family's been following the Knicks. Is Brunson the favorite in your household?
Well, you know what? We love Anunoby.
Yeah, okay.
And you know, another guy who improved under Tibbs. We didn't talk about him.
Yeah, that's true.
He wasn't even getting off the bench in Toronto. And the Knicks bring him in, and he's doing some great things. And then he came, you know, he was very solid this year and very consistent for them. So, I mean, yeah, he's the guy we kind of root for the most. But we yell at everybody.
Fantastic.
Well, again, Rob, we appreciate your time tonight. You know, the Knicks were near and dear to a lot of people's hearts. People were waiting for a Game 7. It didn't happen. But, you know, your expertise tonight was great, and hopefully we can have you on in the future. And whatever it might be, St. John's or the Knicks or something like maybe that, we could talk that again.
A little NBA draft maybe coming up?
I got to start reading on these guys. I don't watch much college basketball, but I'd be happy to do that.
Well, and I'm sure we could talk a whole hour probably on the difference of college basketball these days.
Yep.
But, yeah, like Chris said, we appreciate everything. Great catching up with you again, and we'll talk soon.
All right, guys. Thanks very much.
Absolutely.
All right, all the best.
Bob Dan, former NBA player with the Nuggets, coach, and St. John's. Just a great job. It's really interesting how he kind of said early in the interview how his family was so Knicks oriented, and they kind of adopted it. That's cool. And
even though they're living down south, you pick up a team, and
absolutely
that's the way it goes. And
well, and he doesn't sound like he's living down south. He still has that.
Yeah,
that
he's got the Queens.
He's got the Queens accent, but not Queens. Now we're going to the Bronx, and we're gonna bring in our friend Brian Palermo, who's gonna fill us in here a little bit, a little late. Yankee talk tonight. I know that they're up in this game. It hit a little bit of a rough stretch, but that's, you know, saying that against the Dodgers, is all relative. But Brian, welcome in. How's everything going?
Good. Good to talk to you guys. It's been a while, but happy to be back on here.
Yeah, we haven't talked in a while, and the Yankee season has started off pretty well. Obviously, first and foremost, you have to talk about a guy that's hitting close to 400 and dominating any pitcher that he sees. And can you talk about this year's dominance of Aaron Judge and where that puts him on the pedestal?
Oh, it wasn't Juan Soto. I thought Cappy was bringing up. Oh, no, that's the wrong guy. I'm sorry.
I mean, it's anytime you're talking about any hitter, you know, hovering their average around 400 when it's June. That's just crazy to begin with. But then you talk about someone who slugs and hits for average, hits for power. His strikeouts are down. You know, earlier in his career, he had a little trouble laying off that slider down the way it would always get him. And, you know, he's really focused on that the last couple of years, really improved that. But he is it's unbelievable. You know, two home runs yesterday, even though they didn't have a good game. But he's truly something to watch. And, you know, anytime he's up, you gotta make sure your eyes are glued to the screen.
Unbelievable. The power that, you know, out of nowhere, just, you know, home runs. And I'm surprised that people don't walk him more. But I guess maybe this year with a little bit of Ben Rice and Jason Dominguez, the Goldschmidt's hitting above him, but I'm just surprised that people don't walk him more than they actually do.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, they're going to start, obviously. I know Ron Washington, it's hard to watch these West Coast games when they're starting at 10, but, you know, I did check up on Twitter the next day, and the Angels walked him twice in the first two innings the other day, so... if there's a spot to pitch around him and there's a base open or something early in the game, like he's not getting anything to hit. So, you're going to start seeing that more and more with just, I mean, obviously Soto's not there to protect him. You know, there's not another guy like that in the lineup, but there's plenty of guys who are contributing very well. But yeah, it's Judge's way far in front of the pack. So you're going to take your chances with someone else.
Yeah. Give me your insight into the Yankees starting pitching, highs and maybe a couple of lows, but for the most part, I think you got to be pretty impressed.
Yeah, I mean, they started out, you know, April was a little up and down, but, you know, in the month of May, they were unbelievable as a starting rotation. I know Warren had a really tough start last night, but he had a bunch of starts, you know, strung together in a row where he was really good. Some of his, you know, analytic stuff, his spin rate and his breaking ball, that sweeper he throws is just nasty. So even he was contributing. And I got to give the Yankees credit. You know, someone like a Warren, he's had some rough starts, and at times I'm like, you know, can we run someone else out there? But they stick by their guys, and someone they believe in, he gets plenty of chances. It kind of reminds me of, you know, what they did with Clark Schmidt a couple of years ago. You know, he's struggling a little bit, but they let him figure it out at the major league level, and he turns into a really solid pitcher. So I kind of see Warren having that same path that Clark Schmidt had. But how about those two lefties at the top when you got Fried and Rodon? You know, they're been unbelievable this year. Fried, what a signing with Gerrit Cole going down, the way that he's kind of just assumed that ace role, and he's been unbelievable. Again, he was a little shaky the other night, but, you know, he's human. Everyone's going to have a bad start. And then Rodon's been unbelievable. He's striking everybody out, and his ERA was a little inflated early on, but even those starts, they were really good. And then I think there was a couple in April where right at the end, you know, he gave up a 3-run home run, which just kind of inflated his numbers, but he's brought that way down. His ERA's in the twos, striking out a ton of guys. So those two guys at the top, you know, you feel really good about things.
516-623-1240. We're talking with Brian Palermo, getting some Yankee updates as we hit this for the first time this year. Goldschmidt, Bellinger, what's your thoughts so far? You know, now you have three MVPs on the same team. Your thoughts on them so far this year?
They've been awesome. They're awesome players. I mean, Goldschmidt, you just, when you hear like someone say just a professional hitter, he's up right now as we speak, but he's been awesome. Like, with two strikes, it's almost like when Jeff Nelson, one of the Yankees color guys, he always talks about, he just looks like right center, and he just keeps his approach. He does not stray away from his approach, and he's just getting base hits to right field. He's getting a little older. Maybe his power's down a little bit, but he's just a great hitter. You know, his average, what is he, hitting 350 or something? And then Bellinger, he had a little slow start in April, but he's been really good in May, and that's just someone, he's so athletic, he runs the bases well. You put him in center field, you put him in left field, you put him in right field, you put him at first base, and he's going to be, you know, a plus-plus defender. So those guys have really, you know, fit in well so far this year.
Any worries in the bullpen? I know, you know, Williams had some tough parts, you know, they had to go to a different closer. Are you okay with the way it's setting up right now?
I mean, I feel comfortable with Luke Weaver closing games. So, you know, obviously, Williams is very high expectations. He's one of the lowest ERAs for relief pitchers, you know, in the history of baseball, you know, coming into the year. So he had very high expectations. And even when he was struggling, you know, the underlying numbers were okay. So, you know, these guys, they're people, you know, he's in a new city, and, you know, you got to adjust all that stuff. So, I still think he's going to figure it out, and he's going to get some really big outs down the line. You can never have enough pitching, so, you know, when you talk about what they may add in a couple months of the trade deadline, you're going to probably look for some high leverage relievers, maybe a right-handed bat. But yeah, the bullpen's been solid. Weaver's been great.
Kawhi Carrasco's back.
He looks like he's his old self again. So, you know, some encouraging stuff. You got guys like Tim Hill, and they're all contributing.
Brian, I made a little bit of a joke about Juan Soto, you know, before, but I wanted to ask you, were you surprised that, I mean, obviously the Yankee fans were going to give him, you know, a rough welcome, but the whole turning their backs to him while he went out, and do you think they were a little harsh on him, or was that really, you know, deserving?
I mean, maybe a little bit. I mean, I don't really feel bitter towards him. You know, he was there for 1 year. He was a great player. You know, I probably would have been a little more hurt if that's like a guy who came up through the system and was right there for a long time. But yeah. I wouldn't say that, me. But, you know, the Bronx is a tough place. So to say I'm surprised with the reception he got, I would be lying. But yeah, I mean, it is what it is. The fans want to have fun with it too, you know. So if that gets him a little more into the game, you know, they're going to do it.
Well, sure.
And I thought he handled it very well, though. You know, tipping his cap and everything. You know, he that's Juan Soto for you. So I thought he handled it very well.
Well, he He does pretty much, you know, most things correctly. And, yeah, I thought he did a good job with that. And it is hard, though, I'm sure, if the shoe was on the other foot as a Met fan, if he didn't come to the Mets over, you know, I mean, listen, the money was incredible no matter who and which team he was going to go to. But, in essence, it really wasn't that big of a difference. And especially when he starts to talk about that, at least through back channels, that he misses being on the Yankees. I'm surprised they weren't harder on him.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, obviously, he's a 15-year deal. You can't judge anything too quick. But if you look at where the Yankees are, and obviously Soto is an unbelievable hitter, generational talent. But, you know, with Gerrit Cole going down, can you imagine what the Yankees would look like now if they didn't have Max Fried and, you know, it allowed them to pivot. That. And I'm not saying Cody Bellinger is Juan Soto, but
fantastic,
you know, when you add a Devin Williams, Max Fried and Cody Bellinger as a pivot to not getting Soto, you know, I think Cashman did a very good job. I'm not saying, you know, they are Juan Soto, but I don't even want to think about what they look like without Max Fried towing the slab every 5 days.
All right, so this is not JV baseball at East Rockaway, but this is New York Yankees in the Bronx. Let's say in 2 weeks, a guy by the name of Giancarlo Stanton is looking really good, hitting some balls down in the minors.
Question.
Where does he fit in? Do you pull somebody? Do you make him the DH and put Ben Rice in the field? Do you pull Dominguez a little bit? What? How do you make that stand up?
So a key thing here that is going to make that even more tough is the season that Trent Grisham is having. You know, that's a name we haven't mentioned today, but he's just been unbelievable when he's playing every day. You know, he was. It's hard to transition to that role. Like, you know, he was a little down last year, but when you're playing sporadically, you can't find that rhythm. That's tough. So that's a tough question, you know. Like, if you ask the way you see Boone talks, like, these things always have a way of figuring themselves out. So you don't want to, you know, stress and worry over it too much. But it is tricky. I know Goldschmidt, was he 38 years old? So, you know, they can spell him and play Rice at first to get Rice some at-bats. But I think when Stanton's back, you know, he's going to get the majority of the DH at bats.
Yeah. Because I don't think
he deserves it. And they won't rush him back, you know, with all his injuries.
Agreed.
Maybe they'll play him 4 or 5 times a week. But, you know, Ben Rice has been great this year. And a nice piece of, you know, versatility that Ben Rice has, believe it or not, is that he came up as a catcher. And, you know, having just a third guy who can catch, it's very valuable and very they need it. But, you know, it's a nice little luxury as well.
Well, with a win tonight, getting yourself to 14 games over 500, I think is a good spot. You know, you're going to have some downs here or there. So, I think it's been a good start for the Yankees, and you know, we'll see where we are at the All-Star break.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you can't win the division in April and May, but you can sure as heck lose it. So, you know, I think coming into this weekend, obviously the Dodgers are a very good team, but coming into this weekend, they had the biggest division lead in baseball. Probably not anymore, but, you know, they're in a very good spot.
Yep. Well, it was good catching up, Brian. We appreciate your time. We'll definitely have you on again to talk a little more Yankees.
Yeah,
and
a little longer segment. I know we're Met-centric here, but we'd love to have you back on for a little bit deeper dive.
For sure. Sounds awesome. Good talking to you guys.
Absolutely, Brian Palermo. Big show tonight, Cap. We had Jamie Loeb, yeah, talking lots of tennis. We're going to have her on again soon. Rob Redan, we'll probably have him back for at least NBA draft. Brian Palermo there. We'll be back 2 weeks. We'll see where the Mets and Yankees are at. Enjoy, everybody.
All right. Have a good night, everybody.
Absolutely. Thanks to Brian Graves.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.